Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The devil is, as always, in the details. What Congress actually agreed to in that budget deal Friday night, if anybody really knows. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's the 11th of April today. And one can imagine a scene in the United States Capitol building late last Friday night that goes something like this. Everybody's tired, they're hungry, they're sick of looking at each other, they just want to go home, and they've got a budget deal in principle. So they say to each other, listen, what do you think? Let's just announce there won't be a government shutdown and figure out the details later. Funny thing is, that's pretty much the way it played out. The deal was cut, everybody went home, and now the government's running on yet another temporary extension, this one good till Thursday night, when the House and Senate are supposed to finalize this year's budget. So staffers are working overtime on the details of that figure out the details later part thing. Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more now on where the $38.5 billion worth of cuts is likely to come from.
Big cuts are coming this year, $13 billion worth in labor, education, and health care. The health reform program to set up state insurance cooperatives will be cut in half. Foreign aid takes a hit. So will highway construction projects. Although Steve Ellis at Taxpayers for Common Sense says most of those projects were orphan earmarks and are easy to get rid of.
Things that were earmarked for projects, even sometimes more than a decade ago, that they can't spend the money. Either the sponsor doesn't want it anymore because it's too expensive, or the underlying facts have changed. And so that's about $685 million that they're able to rescind right off the top.
It's also fairly easy to slash $1.5 billion worth of high-speed rail grants, since some states didn't want them anyway. Farm crop insurance is also on the chopping block. Andy LePerrier, who follows the budget for the International Strategy and Investment Group, says negotiators are trying to spread the pain.
It looks like there's a wide variety of programs that are taking small hits rather than a few programs bearing the brunt of it.
Spending increases for the military will be slowed by the budget compromise. The whole deal could fall through when it comes to the House and Senate floors later this week. But in the end, LePerrier expects rank-and-file lawmakers to back up their leaders.
And it's also a pretty high threshold for one side to be seen as walking away from the deal at this point. That's going to be a very difficult thing to explain. You know, we have this deal. Why are you trying to get out of it?
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
And we go on to round two of the great budget fight of 2011. That would be the debt ceiling. Washington is soon going to reach its legal borrowing limit of $14.3 trillion. Some Republicans don't want to raise that cap. Wall Street says they have to do it. America's biggest banks and even the manager of your 401k holds wads of treasury bonds, the ones that would be defaulted on if the limit's not raised. So the likes of JP Morgan Chase and others are trying to figure out how to save their businesses if the government won't pay. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
The U.S. Treasury, for all of its flaws, has never been a deadbeat. That's why investors buy treasury bonds. But if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling, the Treasury won't be able to pay its bills, and the shockwaves could hit every bank and business in the world. Here's Robert Tipp from Prudential Financial.
The debt ceiling is far more important than the budget showdown that we saw this past week.
JP Morgan Chase is one bank that's putting together a plan to prepare for what happens if the U.S. defaults. Terry Belton is the fixed income strategist there. He says worried investors are already forcing the government to pay more to borrow from them. Foreign investors and governments like China and Japan hold about half of all treasury bonds.
Globally, our clients are very focused on it. It's a reason, I think, why treasury rates rose last week.
Banks can prepare themselves for what happens if the U.S. defaults, but everything they do would be bad for the rest of the economy. For instance, banks would need to hoard cash, so they would have to stop lending. They would ask other banks to give them stronger lines of credit. That would stop other banks from lending. And they would ask for more collateral from their clients. So all kinds of companies would be strapped for cash. Jerry Camizio advises banks for law firm Paul Hastings. He says Congress will have to raise the debt ceiling sooner or later. And later, it will be more expensive because we'll need to bail out the banks again.
the economic catastrophe that could result from default by the U.S. could have the government scrambling to get Congress to reinstitute major aid programs again to the large banks to avoid a replay of a total implosion of the economy.
That's the doomsday scenario. But most people on Wall Street hope and believe it will never come to pass. They expect Congress to raise the ceiling in time. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, surprisingly calm given what Heidi just told us. We'll have the details when we always do. You go to the doctor, she hears your problem, she gives you some advice and guidance, and you walk away thinking that's the same set of recommendations she would follow herself. Seems totally reasonable and quite possibly entirely wrong. Because a study out today from Duke University shows that if you ask a doctor, what would you recommend I do? And then you ask, yeah, but what would you do if you were me? You might get two different answers. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner explains how wearing that white coat changes everything.
Professor Peter Ubel asked hundreds of doctors around the country to imagine this.
Imagine that it was terrible avian bird flu is coming to town. Would you get a vaccine that would keep you healthy from getting the flu, but it does have a chance of paralysis?
And paralysis?
Just your legs become so weak you have to get around on a wheelchair. And many of the doctors said, oh, I don't want that vaccine if it's going to cause me to be in a wheelchair. They were taking their chances on dying of the flu.
He then asked doctors what they would advise a patient.
Those same doctors would recommend getting the vaccine.
This seemed especially curious to Peter Ubel. He's not only a business professor at Duke, he's a doctor.
We're weighing the pros and cons differently when we're making a decision for ourselves than for someone else.
Studies have shown that American doctors tend to recommend more aggressive treatments for their patients than those patients would choose for themselves. That can drive up the cost of care. Last month, Medicare unveiled a plan to reward doctors for taking that extra time to discuss treatment options and risks with their patients. Michael Barry is with the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision Making.
In the past, care has tended to be a little too much slanted toward clinician preferences, and patient preferences haven't been as clearly expressed.
Peter Ubel tells me his own patients can make their preferences quite clear. They tell him, Doc,
do anything you can to keep me out of a wheelchair because I'd rather be dead. And that is almost always wrong.
Eventually, they realize that life in a wheelchair isn't the end of the world.
But they don't predict that up front.
He says they need doctors, and the doctors need doctors, to predict it for them. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Japan got a most unwelcome reminder this morning that today is a month since the earthquake. A magnitude 7 aftershock shook the northeast part of that country today. Almost anywhere else in the world, 7.0 would be called an earthquake in its own right. But the more the earth moves, the more the effects spread beyond just the immediate area of the quake, and the harder it is for Japan to recover. From Tokyo, Marketplace's Scott Tong has more now on how the last month has changed lives and businesses.
A middle-aged man sits in a Tokyo park, clutching a bottle of alcohol. It's not what you think. 46-year-old Hisago Takanahashi is an alcohol distributor. He sits on a picnic blanket, a dozen co-workers around him. Typical salarymen. And they're sipping the company's product, a 50-proof weed alcohol called shochu. Don't let the laughter fool you. Times are bad. Takanahashi's sales have fallen 80% in the months since the disaster. Here in Tokyo, nightlife has tanked and people are staying home.
This is normally a very happy time of year.
Normally, this park would be packed in early April. It's cherry blossom season. But tonight, the lanterns on the cherry tree hang dark because Japan is rationing electricity. Most people know about the damaged Fukushima nuclear plant, but 19 other plants are offline too. And everyone in Japan is hurting.
Salarymen are all affected by the power outage. The trains aren't reliable anymore, so people go home early instead of going out. My own commute went from 2 hours a day to four since they canceled the express train.
trains in Japan are so reliable you can usually set your watch by them. Not now. Takanahashi, like many others, is critical of the beleaguered Tokyo Electric Power Company.
The power company says maybe today we'll have a blackout, but they don't tell us exactly when. If they did, restaurants could plan, but if you don't know when the power will be on, nobody can stay in business.
This is going to drag on and on.
Andrew DeWitt teaches political economy at Rikkyo University in Tokyo.
And so the longer this goes on, the more damage the country receives.
DeWitt says this is going to dent Tokyo's reputation, its brand as a financial center. Already, some multinational companies have moved workers to places like Hong Kong, where there's no radiation fear, and the lights are still on.
You had this massive departure of foreigners, especially concentrated in finance. A lot of those people aren't going to come back.
But Tokyo locals, like booze distributor Hisano Takanahashi and his pals, are going nowhere. In a bit of dark humor, he jokes that this may be the last supper, as in last company outing before the firm goes under. And he frets about that other threat, radiation.
The American government says we should stay 50 miles away from the plant, but the Japanese government says 20. We don't trust our government.
A salesman not trusting someone else. And Takanahashi's next point comes as another twist.
If I ingest radiation and get cancer in 20 years, that's okay. I'll be old by then. But it's my two daughters I'm concerned about.
A street performer wanders over to Takanahashi's group. The salaryman wants something cheerful, so the musician plays Banzai. So happy I met you. Hope we stay together. Hisano Takanahashi and his fellow salesmen are selling themselves a little happiness in a city effectively under curfew. The government's new plan is for businesses to cut power use by up to 25% for who knows how long. In Tokyo, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott's back on the show on Wednesday with more stories of individuals trying to help get Japan back to business. And now, let's do the numbers. Wait and see on Wall Street today, ahead of some of the latest rounds of corporate earnings. The Dow Industrials barely eked out a gain, just a single point, closed at 12,381. The NASDAQ reversed 8 points, about a third of 1%, finished at 2,771. The S&P 500 whittled off 3 points, around a quarter of 1%, wrapped up the trading day at 1,324. Just after the closing bell, Alcoa kicked off a new season of earnings reports with a first quarter profit that topped expectations. Stock in the aluminum giant had lost around 0.8% during the trading day. Oil prices backed off a 30-month high, just above $109 a barrel today. Stock in Anadarko Petroleum fell nearly 4.25% today. Chevron retreated 1.75%. ExxonMobil shares slid nearly 1%. ConocoPhillips lost 0.8%. Bond prices rose, pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.59%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The International Energy Agency issues its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the world. The Treasury Department releases the federal budget for March. And the Senate Finance Committee discusses tax administration across the globe. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Most mentions of the traditional economic equation of supply and demand leave out the third element. That'd be price. Supply and demand change, so too does how much something costs. You turn that equation just a little bit sideways, though, and you notice that price often affects demand. And that's exactly what's happening at the gas pump. Gasoline sales have now fallen for 5 straight weeks. That's according to a division of MasterCard that tracks spending at 140,000 gas stations across the country. Average prices for regular have now topped $3.50 a gallon in every state but Wyoming. We went down the road toward $4 gallon gas a couple of years ago, cut back our driving sharply until gas got cheaper. And our senior business correspondent Bob Moon suggests history may repeat itself this time.
Just last week, President Obama heard an appeal at a town hall meeting in Pennsylvania. Can't something be done to bring gas prices down? He told his questioner that, to be honest, there's no quick fix. Then Mr. Obama sounded surprised to learn the man still drives what the president called a big monster truck.
If you're complaining about the price of gas and you're only getting 8 miles a gallon, you know, well, you may have a big family, but it's probably not that big. How many you have? 10 kids, you say? 10 kids? Well, you definitely need a hybrid van then.
If it doesn't hurt your wallet enough, you're not going to change your behavior.
Rebecca Lindland is an analyst at IHS Automotive. Although Ford reports small car sales are up 6% in 3 months, the carmaker is seeing only a very modest rise in hybrid sales, and Lindland says that doesn't necessarily bode well for a significant shift in attitudes.
Typically, consumers will change their buying behavior for 3 to 4 months, and then they will go back to the larger vehicles that they have been buying before any such gas crisis.
It could be deja vu all over. Turns out prices might actually be peaking, according to Tom Kloza of the Oil Price Information Service. He's not expecting the cost of gasoline to go as high as some analysts have been predicting.
I would say it's less than 50-50 that national prices get to four. And I think there's an awful good chance that what you pay on Easter Sunday will be higher than what you pay on July 4th and Labor Day. I believe that this year is front-end loaded with the higher prices in the first 5 months of the year.
In other words, Americans who figure this too shall pass could get their wish for now. But Kloza warns that we could well be faced with what he calls apocalyptic prices before we know it, which leads us full circle back to President Obama's advice.
Like I said, if you're getting 8 miles a gallon, you may want to think about a trade-in.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here's the downside of that budget deal that Congress and the White House reached Friday night. To be brief, it goes like this. We ain't seen nothing yet, because the real fight is still coming up, as we heard elsewhere in the broadcast today, over next year's budget and the long-term national debt. Robert Samuelson is a columnist for Newsweek magazine and the Washington Post, and he wrote in the paper today that what we've got is, in fact, a federal government that is suicidal, his words, and that we the people are to blame.
What I meant by that is that over the years, government has basically promised people more than it can realistically deliver, and therefore people inevitably must be disappointed because the government has overpromised in the past.
For all those problems, though, the American people writ large, most of us get a healthy dose of benefit from the government. I mean, you quote some Census Bureau figures this morning.
And that is one of the reasons that we find it so difficult to approach and do anything about these problems. The Census Bureau estimates that roughly half the population gets some direct benefit. But if you then count some of the very large, significant tax breaks, my guess is that 3/4 or more of the American population are getting some significant benefit from the government. And therefore, although everybody is in favor of deficit reduction and tax reform, when you actually try to do it, you run into these huge constituencies that don't want their benefits changed. And it becomes very difficult to do anything.
Seems to me it's the very definition of we have met the enemy and it is us.
That's correct. People complain about government not being terribly democratic with a small d, but just the opposite is actually the case. Politicians are extremely responsive to their constituents, and therefore they are inclined to give them whatever they ask for. A deficit is the kind of default position of a government and a political system that can't really decide what's the most important and how to create sensible priorities.
As we've all seen the past week or so with the debate over the shutdown, you can't talk about debt and deficit without talking about politics. And you quote James Q. Wilson, the political thinker, as saying, you know, politics used to be about just a couple of things in this country, and now it's about everything.
We lost all sense of discipline, I think, in the 60s and the 70s, and we were very optimistic about economic growth. We felt the economy would grow rapidly forever, and we felt we could finance almost anything. And therefore, we enacted an enormous number of new programs to do almost everything that we thought needed to be done. And now we are the unfortunate heirs of that legacy, but we're still laboring, it seems to me, under the illusion that we can afford everything. Now the deficits have reached a huge proportion. mainly because of a really terrible recession that we had. But more importantly are the aging of the population and the combination of the numbers of those people and the fact that we have not been able to control health costs now makes the deficits go up enormously, and they are now, to a large extent, intractable.
If, though, the debt and deficit levels that we have reached are intractable, as you say, now what do we do? Where do we go?
Well, let me just start by saying I hope that I'm wrong. And I hope that my wife would say I'm wrong all the time, and this may be another instance. It is possible that this bit of theater that we had over the last 2 weeks about the government shutdown, in an optimistic reading, might be the opening chapter of an attempt by the political system to really hammer out some sort of significant changes in our budget priorities so that we begin to bring our long-term spending commitments and our willingness to be taxed back into balance.
Robert Samuelson is a columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post. His most recent book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. Mr. Samuelson, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
One more budgeting note before we move on. The Pentagon said today the bill for the first 17 days of the Libyan no-fly zone, that would be through April the 4th, came to $608 million. That's just marginal costs, by the way. Extra expenses beyond normal operations and regular salaries. All the stuff that would have had to have been paid anyhow. Washington lobbyists like to throw parties. It's a pretty effective way to get their people close to Congress people. But there are only so many cocktail and heavy hors d'oeuvre parties one can go to, I imagine, which is why the American Fly Fishing Trade Association is going out on the river this week. They're taking lawmakers along to talk about conservation and fisheries management. The gathering comes as fly fishermen are facing some challenges. For years, they've used rooster feathers, pricey ones at that, to tie the intricate flies to get the fish to bite. This year, though, there's stiff competition for all that plumage. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Gabrielle Aquaro has worked in Southern California hair salons for 15 years, so she's always on the lookout for the latest trend. About 6 months ago,
I saw these feather pieces in this girl's hair. She had some wild, curly hair, and I thought, that looks really cool. What is that?
So she mentioned the feathers to her dad.
He says, I've got just the thing for you, kid. Come on over.
Well, I thought it was a great idea, and I had my fly tying equipment in the garage just gathering dust.
In his kit, Ted Aquaro had a stash of long, thin feathers. Gabrielle bundled them a few at a time and layered them into her client's hair for $25 a pop.
And are you happy with that placement?
Yes. No, I love it.
Other stylists have also discovered the trend.
And now it's blown up because now, you know, Steven Tyler on American Idol's got bushels of feathers.
And Hilary Duff and Miley Cyrus.
Everybody's into it.
Which is fine for Steve Ellis, owner of a fly shop in Southern California. He supplies Aquaro's feathers and says business has been booming.
Oh, we love it. We'd like to see all these cute girls come in and we have a good time with. We're all those old crotchety guys in here and we just love it.
But some of his customers don't, like this guy, Rich Peters.
Are you a fisherman?
No, I just tie flies.
He's a fisherman who's not very good at it.
Well, I can't tie him anymore because I can't get any feathers. These guys don't have any feathers.
Oh, stop.
Thing is, it's kind of true. Fly shops across the country have been selling out of feathers. And the problem goes back to one farm.
I'm Tom Whiting. I'm the owner and founder of Whiting Farms, where we grow the feathers for the fly tying world.
7 out of 10 top fly feathers are Whiting feathers.
But which also are used now in the fashion world.
Whiting is a geneticist in western Colorado. He raises roosters, about 65,000 at a time. As much as a third of his sales now go to fashion.
We have orders far in excess of what we have in our system.
For years, Whiting was looking for that kind of success. He sold feathers to craft stores, makers of Hawaiian leis, even Vegas showgirls. But he's never seen demand like this. He raised prices on pelts of the popular feathers about 40%. But even that hasn't slowed sales.
They were going on eBay for $100 to $150 a piece when the suggested retail price was like $36.
Whiting says it takes more than a year to boost production. In the meantime, he's reluctant to raise prices too much.
Because when this fad sort of runs its course, My core business is fly tying feathers, whom I don't think they will pay those type of fashion prices. And I would be sort of shooting myself in the foot.
Gabriella Aquaro doesn't see the fad running its course anytime soon.
You know, we were joking around that Whiting Farms is waiting for their roosters to die, because the minute that sucker's dead, they're on him.
The question is, who gets the feathers? Fly fishermen or their daughters? I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, if you happen to see the Facebook movie, The Social Network, you're familiar with the Winklevoss twins, the snooty brothers who say Mark Zuckerberg stole the idea for Facebook from them. If you didn't see the movie, well, they're two snooty brothers who say Mark Zuckerberg stole the idea for Facebook from them. Anyway, they've been trying for years now to reverse a deal they made with Zuckerberg to settle a lawsuit they filed against him. The complaint basically was that he hoodwinked them into taking less than they were entitled to. Court today said, nuh-uh, you guys went to Harvard. You are sophisticated parties to the deal. The Winklevoss slice of Facebook right now, by the way, about $160 million. And on that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow tacked on a single point, just a tiny fraction of 1%. The Nasdaq backtracked 8 points. That's about a third percent. The S&P 500 shaved off 3 points, about a quarter of 1%. Our producers include Avshai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time, back here, European farmers say they can't keep up with the demand for food unless government handouts keep coming.
We have to keep our subsidies. We have to help farmers to produce more tomorrow.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.